ready, got the hose hooked up and got it ready.
Yeah.
So then when you woke me up, told me it was time, then I went ahead and started filling the pool.
I called my midwife. I called my doula and friend Sarah, and then my sister Sam, and then my other two friends, Megan and Danielle. I just had everybody come because I knew things were gonna pick up faster. Megan arrived first, and she started putting hot rice bags on my back, which is what I liked with my labor with Carson. We had music playing, we had candles lit, the lights were dimmed. It was just very relaxing. Then Sarah came, then my midwife's assistant came, then my midwife came, and she just gets her supplies out, gets whatever she thinks she might need, and just watches me, just tries to figure out where I'm at in labor by my movements and my actions. I walked around the house and I sat on the birth ball and I kind of squatted by the couch and just tried to keep moving with my labor with Carson. I felt like I was afraid to move. I'd never had a natural birth before. I just kind of stayed in the same positions. So that was really neat this time that I just decided to go with it. At one point, I was sitting on the ball in the corner of the room and I felt a thud. And I told my midwife, I think my water's going to break soon. So I got in the pool after that and then labored for a little bit longer. And then I felt the urge to push. I felt her head crowning. And then I made a few pushes for her head. Then her body just followed, whereas Carson was twice as big and took a while to push out.
It was just neat without having any medication or anything. You knew exactly where you were in birth. You knew what your body was doing. You knew when to go get the boys so they'd be there, and then you're in control and relaxed, and you knew what you were doing. What was the happiest moment of Birth of Scarlet?
That I was able to share it with my closest friends and family and have my first daughter and have them share that experience with me.
What are the most important lessons you've learned about birth?
From our first experience in the hospital, it was so scary and unpredictable, and we just felt so out of control. I feel like we've done so much work just to make our own decisions, and they've turned out to be such great experiences, and they've changed the way we've parented our children.
What are the most important things you learned about me?
I've learned how supportive you are and how trusting you are of me and my decisions, and I feel like we've made them together and they've turned out really, really good.
What is the earliest memory of wanting to have home birth?
When I was pregnant with Carson and I was starting to get high anxiety about going to the hospital, just the people there and not feeling like I can stick up for myself and make my own choices and telling people I don't want certain procedures done. And then I started meeting people who had home birth. So I slowly started to learn about it and discover that was the best place for us.
What would you like Scarlett to know about you as a mother?
I hope that she knows that we've tried to make the best decisions for her that I have as a mother, and I'd like her to know that we love her.
How has being a parent changed you?
I feel like it's completely changed me. I'm passionate about things I never thought I would be. It's just made me a better person. I feel like I actually make my own decisions. I'm trying to make good choices for them. What are the most important lessons you've learned about birth and about fatherhood?
To research everything, either be home or in the hospital, or just research and learn about it so you know what questions to ask and you know what's supposed to happen.
What are the most important things you've learned about me?
That you're strong and brave and committed, and
What is your earliest memory of wanting to have a home birth?
it was you telling me you wanted home birth and me thinking you're crazy, and then after researching it, it ended up being a educated decision. So it was me just more supporting your decisions and you influencing me on that.
What would you like Scarlett to know about her birth?
That it went how nature intended it for to go.
Abby and Mike Fish's story is part of our series on home birth and midwifery in Illinois. Tomorrow, Amy and Ben Russell of Bloomington talk about their choice of home birth with a certified nurse midwife for their third child after having their first two babies at hospitals. For more on our series, visit will.illinois.edu and search under Home Birth, or find us on Twitter with the hashtag ILHomeBirth. A new session of the Illinois General Assembly has begun. The outgoing class of legislators left the incoming one with quite a burden. Last night, the previous General Assembly adjourned without doing anything to reduce Illinois' massive pension debt. There were a few last-minute tries, though, as Amanda Vinicky reports.
If there was a time for a pension overhaul to pass, it was yesterday. That was the prevailing wisdom anyway. After all, back in September, House Speaker Mike Madigan and Senate President John Cullerton signaled it would come in the new year. And this was the last time dozens of lame duck legislators, free from having to worry about their next campaign, would be able to cast a vote. But no. First, the House.
I hereby move that this session of the General Assembly do stand adjourned, sine die die.
And then the Senate.
The ayes have it, and the Senate stands adjourned, sine die.
Adjourned without sending anything to Governor Pat Quinn to ease Illinois' ever-growing pension problem. Not that there weren't attempts, including a surprise last-ditch effort by Quinn himself.
We have to take an extraordinary action to help break the gridlock.
That's the governor taking the unusual step of appearing before a legislative committee to be grilled on a newly cooked up plan. Quinn proposed tasking a commission with devising a way to get Illinois' pension systems back on track. But not just any commission. This would be a sort of super committee with extraordinary powers. Whatever it came up with would automatically become law, unless a majority of the General Assembly voted to reject it, a plan devised as an end run around political gridlock.
We have to understand that this is an emergency, and it does require, under this emergency situation, a structure that allows us to move forward.
Unions who've battled every other pension proposal brought before the General Assembly especially didn't like this one. The Illinois Federation of Teachers, Dan Montgomery.
This, you could say, is clever. I would say, unfortunately, I think it's kind of a cynical and seemingly reasonable but rather sad attempt to get something done.
Cinda Klickna of the Illinois Education Association.
Why do we even need a General Assembly if everything can be turned over to a commission? It's just crazy.
And the AFL-CIO's John Kerrigan.
I would just simply characterize this as a desperate Hail Mary pass.
But it wasn't just unions. Legislators themselves mocked the plan. Here's Quinn's fellow, though outspoken, Democrat Representative Jack Franks of Marengo.
This is an embarrassing desperation ploy from a guy who can't get anything done.
Although representatives passed Quinn's measure out of a committee, several say it was mostly a courtesy to the governor. Then the full House adjourned without ever voting on it. The House didn't take up two other pension proposals either because there weren't enough votes to pass them. One plan, preferred by Senate President John Cullerton, passed out of that chamber back in May. The other garnered a lot of attention earlier this week when it got bipartisan support from a House panel. Supporters of those separate proposals can unite in frustration that they stalled. But otherwise, the new session is starting off with a showdown between the two plans. The main sponsors, President Cullerton and Democratic Representative Elaine Nekritz of Northbrook, each have questions about the legality of the other's plan. Senate Republican leader Christine Redonio says it leaves her concerned that nothing will get accomplished.
Democrats have had clear majorities now for 10 years. Republicans have worked very hard on pension reform. The problem is the Democrat majorities do not agree on pension reform, and frankly, I'm not sure they want it.
Despite Redonio's pessimism, both Cullerton and Nekritz say they're willing to compromise. Part of the rush to pass something, anything, is to hold off bond rating agencies, which have threatened to lower Illinois' already weak credit rating. Cullerton says there's no need for them to rush to judgment over the standstill.
The pension system and the state are in no way bankrupt. It's just not true.
But Illinois already has the lowest credit rating of any state, and some legislators speculate, fear even, that it'll take a further downgrade to force reluctant politicians to get on board. While individual lawmakers have their own reasons for opposing various plans, Representative Nekritz says there's one overarching reason.
We're taking hundreds of thousands of people and impacting their pocketbook in a very direct way, in a way that says, I can't, you know, I made you a promise and I can't keep it.
That difficulty doesn't go away, even if there are fresh faces in the General Assembly. Fresh faces who, as of today, will begin building up pensions of their own. I'm Amanda Vinicky.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages at 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign.
For 26 years, 10,000 Villages has been offering fairly traded gift items for family and friends, from coffee, tea, and chocolate to a collection of personal accessories and home decor.
It's the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 9th of January, 2013. It's the birthday of the playwright Brian Friel, born in County Tyrone, Ireland, 1929. Went to seminary, decided not to become a priest, dropped out, became a school teacher. And the year he turned 30, one of his stories appeared in the New Yorker magazine, and he was so encouraged he quit teaching to write full-time. The Irish theater director Tyrone Guthrie was a fan of Brian Friel's stories in The New Yorker, and when the Guthrie Theater had its opening in Minneapolis in 1963, Guthrie invited Brian Friel to come along to America and to watch the rehearsal and production process of Hamlet. And within a year, Friel had written his first stage play for production, Philadelphia, Here I Come, about a young man named Gareth O'Donnell leaving his village in County Donegal and heading for America. The play had its premiere in Dublin, 1964, then London, then Broadway, was very popular. He wrote some more plays in the 70s, then had a long spell of writer's block in the mid-80s. Went to see the London opening of a Chekhov adaptation, and afterward went for a walk along the Thames with a friend. They saw some homeless people huddled there in the cold. Friel mentioned that two of his spinster aunts had left Ireland to go to London, ended up alone and homeless, and he decided to write about his aunts. And that was his play Dancing at Lunason. It was the most commercially successful play of his life, and in 1998 was made into a movie starring Meryl Streep. It's the birthday of Simone de Beauvoir, born in Paris in 1908. She went off to the Sorbonne, and there she met her lifelong partner, Jean-Paul Sartre. They fell in love, but instead of getting married, they decided to form a pact. They would each have affairs with other people, but they would tell each other everything, and they would meet regularly in a cafe and show each other whatever they were working on. And Jean-Paul Sartre went off to write his book Being and Nothingness in 1943, and Simone de Beauvoir, her book The Second Sex in 1949, in which she wrote, "One is not born a woman,